DW Inside Europe.
Hello and welcome. I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. On today's programme,
it couldn't be a more difficult moment for the German government to break up. Obviously, what you heard from the government is that they will work with whoever is in the White House in Washington. But essentially, this comes at a very difficult time when not only Germany, but also Europe were trying to understand how they would position themselves when it comes to this new Trump government.
Germany's coalition government collapses. Europe reacts to Trump's re-election in the US. And in Serbia, a fatal railway accident feeds unrest over corruption allegations. It's been a challenging week. We'll do our best to guide you through.
Wie geht es nun weiter? Bundesminister Lindner wird vom Bundespräsidenten entlassen.
That is the sound of German Chancellor Olaf Scholz addressing the nation late on Wednesday evening, announcing the sacking of his finance minister, Christian Lindner, leader of the Liberal FDP party. Hours after Lindner's sacking, the FDP withdrew the rest of its ministers from the cabinet. The political infighting that has been paralysing the coalition is no secret in Germany, but there had been an assumption that in the face of the need to show a united European front in the light of President Trump's re-election in the USA, the three parties, Socialist, Green and Liberal, would limp on until the end of their term. Instead, Wednesday saw not only the concession of Kamala Harris in the United States, but the collapse of the government of Europe's largest economy as well. This is history in the making, as our political correspondent Thomas Sparrow is only too aware. Despite being on holiday in Colombia with a six-hour time difference, he was texting me within minutes of the news breaking and is joining us now via phone to talk us through what has happened and what is likely to happen.
These three parties that formed Germany's three-way coalition, so the Social Democrats, the Greens and the Liberal FDP, so the Free Democrats, were from the beginning very difficult partners. They have very difficult priorities, very different priorities. So the SPD, the Social Democrats and the Greens are essentially left-wing parties. They believe in a strong state. They believe that there's a lot of money needed for social policy, whereas the FDP is actually the contrary, if you want. They believe in a sort of lean state that should only intervene in, let's say, very specific circumstances. They argue for financial restraint. And what we've seen in the last 3 years is basically that they fought on basically every major issue. And the major issue that actually led to the coalition now to fall apart was finances, was basically the discussion about the budget for Germany in the next year. You may know that Germany is in a very difficult financial situation, and as such, there were different approaches from the three parties when it came to how Germany should approach those financial difficulties. So whereas Christian Lindner, so the finance minister that was sacked, alleged basically that Chancellor Scholz was asking him or forcing him to ignore the debt limit rules that, by the way, are enshrined in Germany's constitution. Scholz, on the other hand, and the Greens as well, were basically accusing the Free Democrats of basically not being flexible enough in very difficult times and essentially stressing that there should be a fiscal emergency now and that that should allow to free up extra funds.
And as you say, the accusations and the acrimony, it's very, very heavy stuff. I mean, we've had the usually very mild-mannered Chancellor Scholz accusing Christian Lindner of the FDP of betraying his trust and of pursuing small-minded party politics at the expense of the country.
That's correct. And it seemed clear that the discussions that in the past had happened behind closed doors were now basically coming out into the public. Accusations on both sides of political manoeuvring, of basically not putting the country as a top priority, but rather focusing on party politics. What happens next is essentially that Chancellor Scholz will want to continue governing in a minority government with the Greens, so with the other coalition partner. this could happen, but it would be very difficult because it would require basically the Social Democrats and the Greens to find majorities outside of the minority government when it comes to, for example, passing important laws in Parliament. The Chancellor stressed that he would call for a vote of confidence in Parliament in January. If that fails, then there would be a formal request for the federal president of Frank-Walter Steinmeier to dissolve Parliament, and that would need to happen in the space of 21 days. And then after that, there would be elections within 60 days. That's the plan that Scholz presented yesterday, essentially. And the opposition have stressed that that needs to happen much faster, that essentially what is happening now in Germany is that if you wait until January to call for that vote of confidence, if then you have to wait for Parliament to be dissolved, if then you have to wait 60 days for an election to be held, if afterwards you have to find coalition partners to work together, that would essentially leave Germany for many months without a functioning government, and that essentially all this process has to happen much earlier. It has to happen very soon.
And of course, this is all happening against the backdrop of regime change across the Atlantic with the re-election of Donald Trump.
It couldn't be a more difficult moment for the German government to break up. Obviously, what you heard from the government is that they will work with whoever is in the White House in Washington. But essentially, this comes at a very difficult time when not only Germany, but also Europe were trying to understand how they would position themselves when it comes to this new Trump government. There were hopes in Germany that maybe Donald Trump's election would keep the three partners in the German coalition together, understanding that the challenges now from the international perspective are very big, and that one area in which the three partners had managed to work together was in foreign policy. But what we saw is not only that the election of Donald Trump sent shockwaves in Europe, in Germany in particular, but now also you have a political crisis in the country which is developing and which will create new alliances, create new positionings from the different parties. So you have a very difficult national situation and a very complicated international situation as well for Germany.
And we'll have more European perspectives on the re-election of Donald Trump in the US coming up very shortly. But for now, Thomas Sparrow, thank you so much for joining us to talk us through the German perspective.
Thank you very much, Kate.
DW's political correspondent, Thomas Sparrow there. And now to what in any other week would have been our top news of the programme, the re-election of President Donald Trump in the USA and what it means for Europe. Here's Terry Schultz with the view from Brussels.
European reaction to the landslide success of Donald Trump has made it dramatically clear that the transatlantic relationship is more important than ever. Even those who had rocky relationships with Trump in his first term rushed to congratulate him in the warmest tones they could muster. European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen is known to have butted heads with Trump before, but as she arrived Thursday at a meeting of European leaders in Budapest, she looked to the future.
Let me take the opportunity to again congratulate Donald J. Trump for his clear victory. I'm looking forward to working with him again to strengthen the transatlantic bond.
NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte has been called the new Trump whisperer, following the success of his predecessor Jens Stoltenberg in keeping the bombastic U.S. leader from carrying out his worst threats against NATO. Rutte is choosing the extremely friendly approach, playing on Trump's own notion that he is responsible for NATO allies increasing their defense spending faster than they may have initially done.
I want to congratulate again President Trump upon his re-election. It was really a huge success for him, including capturing the House and the Senate. I look forward to work with him again. When he was president, he was the one in NATO who stimulated us to move over the 2%. And now, also thanks to him, NATO, if you take out the numbers of the US for a moment, is above the 2%. And I think very much that is his doing, his success, and we need to do more.
That's a theme picked up by European Parliament President Roberta Metsola in her remarks upon arrival at the European political community gathering. She says Europe should stop just reacting to world events wherever they take place.
But rather, what are we going to do? When we say that we stand on our own 2 feet, what does that mean? When we work together, what does that mean? When we discuss strategic autonomy, That means we together, and this is a perfect moment, together with our neighbourhood besides the European Union member states, to discuss a common approach on security, on defence, on Ukraine, on how we react to elections that took place in Moldova, in Georgia, as we go forward, on migration. I quote Donald Tusk when he said the time for geopolitical outsourcing is over, and that is one view that we fully agree with as a European Parliament.
But in Budapest, the leader with perhaps the most to lose from the victory of Donald Trump, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, chose to walk right past the gaggle of reporters without comment. He's hoping to come away from this meeting of shell-shocked European counterparts with pledges they'll do more to help his citizens deal with the literal shell shocks they face every day. This is all the more crucial if Trump keeps his campaign promise to end contributions to Kyiv. Terry Schultz, DW, Brussels.
As we've just heard, the re-election of Donald Trump in the US is potentially of momentous consequence for European security, and nowhere is that being felt more keenly than in Ukraine. Our Kyiv correspondent Nick Connolly sent us these thoughts.
Everyone here in Kyiv is really scratching their head and trying to work out what Donald Trump means for Ukraine. This is, after all, the man who said that he could end this 2.5-year war in 24 hours and do so before setting foot in the White House. But how exactly he intends to do that and whether he'll actually make that a priority, no one can know. His claims during the campaign were read as basically code here in Ukraine for pressuring Zelensky into capitulating to Putin on Putin's terms by pulling the plug on vital American military aid. And if you look a bit closer, there have been different messages from the future vice president, J.D. Vance, talking about Ukraine giving up on its ambition to join NATO, about creating a demilitarized zone along the current front lines, basically freezing the conflict. From a Ukrainian perspective, there were slightly more positive, more nuanced positions from people like Keith Kellogg, a former general who advises Trump on foreign policy, who talked about forcing both sides to the negotiating table by reducing aid to Ukraine if Zelensky doesn't want to budge, but equally increasing aid to Ukraine if it's the Russians who don't want to negotiate. But no one really knows if these things are going to be relevant or Trump's positions going forward. And there's certainly huge worry here in Ukraine about Trump's personal relationship to Putin, especially since we discovered recently about those calls, those contacts between Trump and Putin, even after Trump left office. And that's why Volodymyr Zelensky is doing so much to try and build a personal relationship to Donald Trump. He was very early to congratulate him on Twitter. He was really using Trumpian language about American strength, trying to suggest that Ukraine will also give back by helping to reinforce European security so that America can do less. And we've seen him also praise Trump's family and his kind of the scale of his victory. So really trying to get in his good books. More recently in September, when Zelensky was in DC, he really made a huge effort to actually get a personal meeting with Trump and to really, you know, engage and make sure that there isn't that baggage remaining from 2019. Well, you remember Trump was impeached over accusations that he had tried to get Zelensky to investigate Joe Biden's son over his business dealings in Ukraine. So that was really seen as a huge vulnerability in Ukraine and a real worry that Ukraine was just in Trump's bad books. I think going forward, the kind of message coming from Kyiv is going to be about Ukraine as a symbol for American strength. If America gives up on Ukraine, if America allows Vladimir Putin to walk all over Ukraine, what does that mean for America's prestige in the world and also for Donald Trump's?
Whilst Trump's re-election has been met with fear and trepidation in Kyiv, in Budapest, Prime Minister Viktor Orban was quick to express his joy. As Stefan Voss reminds us, the two men have a lot in common.
It's no secret that most European Union leaders would have preferred Kamala Harris as next president of the United States. But Hungary's Prime Minister Viktor Orban is an exception. He described Trump's win as a much-needed victory of the world. Orban does not play by the EU's rules. He has long been criticized for his perceived authoritarianism and democratic backsliding. He cultivates close ties with Russian President Vladimir Putin and has been a vocal critic of Western military aid to Ukraine. Orban believes the election of his close ally Donald J. Trump will help make Europe great again. He is pleased that Trump opposes the war in Ukraine and could force Kiev and Moscow to negotiate the peace deal. I see a spectacular victory, perhaps the greatest comeback in Western political history, says Orbán in a reaction to Trump's comeback. It's a great encouragement to everyone who believes in will, struggle, perseverance and hope for peace in the world. With Trump, there is now a great chance to defeat the pro-war forces and ensure that the pro-peace forces become a majority in the Western world by the end of the year. The love seems mutual. Trump, eager to have an outspoken ally in the European Union, has praised Orbán, who he has met on several occasions. Trump supports Orbán's anti-migration and other ideological values. The American leader even referenced Orbán in a debate with his rival, Kamala Harris.
Viktor Orbán, one of the most respected men, they call him a strong man. He's a tough person, smart. Prime Minister of Hungary. They said, why is the whole world blowing up? 3 years ago it wasn't. Why is it blowing up? He said, because you need Trump back as president. They were afraid of him. China was afraid, and I don't like to use the word afraid, but I'm just quoting him. China was afraid of him. North Korea was afraid of him. Look at what's going on with North Korea, by the way. He said Russia was afraid of him.
Yet, back in Hungary, the opposition appears lukewarm to Trump's victory. Some opposition parliamentarians say they're looking forward to working with him. But the leader of Hungary's Liberal Momentum Party said Trump's economic and political goals were contrary to Hungary's interests. There are concerns that the Trump presidency could rock world trade, further undermining Hungary's already troubled economy and sharpening conflicts rather than smoothing them. But as long as Hungary's right-wing prime minister remains in power, the transatlantic political bromance between these two controversial leaders looks set to continue. Stefan Bos, DW, Budapest.
The full implications of the upcoming regime change in Washington will be becoming more apparent as the weeks go on. Together with our network of correspondents, we'll be doing our very best to bring you the European perspective every Thursday. Our journalism is and will always be free to access, but if you do want to support us, you can do so by subscribing to our podcast or, even better, by recommending it to a friend. I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. You're listening to Inside Europe. There have been protests in Serbia this week after part of a railway station collapsed, killing 14 people. Novi Sad station formed part of the government's signature infrastructure project, the high-speed line between Belgrade and Budapest. But now opposition parties claim that the collapse is a symptom of broader corruption that could put public safety at risk. Our Balkans correspondent, Guy Delorne, can tell us more.
It was Novi Sad's largest demonstration in decades. More than 20,000 people took to the streets and squares of Serbia's second city, all of them aghast at what had happened the previous Friday. That's when a concrete canopy collapsed at the recently renovated railway station. Tons of concrete, steel and glass crashed down, killing 14 people and leaving the city in shock.
We've been unhappy as a people for a very long time. We don't live well, we don't feel well, and now we don't feel safe either.
Because a six-year-old girl will never blow out seven candles on her birthday cake, because it didn't have to happen, because it's so bad and because corruption kills. kills.
These 14 dead and 3 injured are above all victims of this regime and of everything that has happened in Serbia over the past 12 years.
Some of the protests have turned violent. The protest organisers blamed Agent Provocateur for attacking the City Hall and the offices of the governing Progressive Party. But even if some of the participants were plants, the anger was real and widespread. The overriding sentiment from the people on the streets was that the authorities had put their safety at risk. Serbia's president, Aleksandar Vučić, moved quickly to assure the country that action would be taken.
Tražim od višeg tužilaštva u Novom Sadu.
I ask the Public Prosecutor's Office in Novi Sad and the government of the Republic of Serbia to ensure that those responsible for what happened are brought to justice and punished severely. As for the government, I call for political responsibility. And before that, criminal responsibility too.
The problem for President Vučić is that he's made himself very closely associated with Novi Sad railway station. It's a key stop on the government's flagship infrastructure project, the high-speed line from Belgrade to Budapest. 2 years ago, I travelled with Mr. Vučić on the inaugural service of the first section to open, linking the capital and the second city, and he told me about the project's importance to the country.
This is our way to modern Europe, our way to better and progressive Serbia, and this is something that actually changed the paradigm entirely, and now we have one of the most modern railroads and the most modern trains in the southeast part of Europe.
A rally at Novi Sad station alongside Hungary's Prime Minister Viktor Orban marked the end of that journey and supposedly the inauguration of the renovated facilities. But reconstruction continued, and this summer there was another opening ceremony. So last week's disaster carried heavy symbolism, as well as a high cost in human lives. Construction Minister Goran Vesic resigned, but with great reluctance. I cannot accept guilt for the deaths, he said, because I and the people who work with me have not an ounce of responsibility for the tragedy that occurred. That's not going to wash with Serbia's opposition parties. They've been quick to attack President Vučić and his Progressive Party government, claiming corruption and a culture of impunity are behind the canopy collapse.
The slogan of the people is that we are all below this canopy that's called Serbia, so it can collapse to wherever you are.
Biljana Djordjevic is the co-leader of the Green Left Front.
There is a feeling that this is a core of the Serbian Progressive Party politics because they base their power on the claim that they are building the country. They are building roads, a railway, the construction, and that this increases the living standard. And that if now people feel unsafe about this, and this was the core of their policy and winning power everywhere, then basically their policy is now seen as invalid.
The protests are set to continue, even as the authorities investigate why the canopy collapsed. Finding quick and credible answers will be the key to calming the crowds. Otherwise, it could be a bumpy ride for President Vučić and the government. Guy Delorne, DW, Ljubljana.
A quick reminder of our feedback address here, insideeurope@dw.com. It's been quite a week, so I'll keep it short. This is Inside Europe. I'm Kate Laycock in Germany.
Thank you.
This is Inside Europe, and I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. Coming up in the next half hour, after the flood, as Spain mourns its dead, tough questions remain to be answered.
The warning that went out to the region's inhabitants, which was sent out by the regional government, only went out at 8:12 p.m. So this was at a moment when many people were already in flooded homes, and certainly where at a moment when many people were stranded in their cars.
Battle of the Scheldt, remembering an often forgotten chapter of World War II, and Wild Goose Chase. More on that later.
Broadcasting from Germany, this is Inside Europe.
Well over 200 people are now confirmed dead, and at least 89 are still missing following last week's devastating flash floods in eastern Spain. That number may be considerably higher, since as yet it only includes people whose families have provided biological samples for identification. We'll be looking in more detail at the failings, both political and infrastructural, which may have compounded these horrific numbers later. First, though, here is our Spain correspondent, Ashish Sharma, with an audio summary of Spain's ongoing nightmare and how it unfolded.
¿Dónde está el coche? ¿Aquí? ¡Ay, bajo! ¡Ay, madre mía!
One of the more dramatic videos posted on social media. Workers in a shopping mall are rushing to get out after it starts flooding. But most have their cars in an underground car park. It's a desperate rush to get out. The voice we hear is a woman making the video. She tells a friend she's worried they'll get trapped, repeatedly saying this is dangerous. Outside, the water level is climbing quickly, and they abandon the car at a gas station and seek shelter. They were rescued, one of the lucky ones. In other videos, we can see and hear the distress. A resident shows the carnage outside her window, cars smashed up on top of one another, mud and water everywhere. She breaks down, showing her front garden. It's completely submerged, water up to the roof of the garage. We left the car outside and it's gone. My husband went to find it and it's completely lost, she cries. Some 215 people have died and dozens more remain unaccounted for. Some regions of Valencia were still without power and clean water at the beginning of the week. Many communities got together to help out. But this has led to anger, and demonstrations took place in Paiporta. Anger at the slowness of help from authorities, but also fury at the fact that SMS storm alert messages were sent so late. One resident explained. He says it was an accumulation. We had no communication, we received no help, there was no clean water, including not even food, and people were still missing. And this led to a build-up of desperation, and then it all came out, he says. On Sunday, shocking scenes greeted Pedro Sanchez, the Prime Minister, and the Spanish King and Queen who visited Paiporta. They were pelted with mud, accompanied by shouts of assassins and get out of here, ringing in their ears. The police say they're now turning attention to subterranean car parks and have been sending in drones to assess the situation. Anger centres around the slowness of warning alerts and help needed. There have been demands for the resignation of the president of the Valencia government, Carlos Mazón, but he's laid the blame at the door of the national government.
Me gustaría comunicar, sobre todo a los vecinos y vecinas de las zonas afectadas, que el gobierno de España...
Meanwhile, the Prime Minister, Pedro Sánchez, declared a first round of aid measures amounting to over 10.6 billion euros to Valencian and some Andalusian communities which have been affected. The rains are now falling in the Catalan region. Amidst rising water, there is also rising anger as to who takes responsibility for the tragedy that has been seen in Valencia. Ashish Sharma, DW, Madrid.
So how could this have happened? Man-made climate change is, of course, the main answer. Rainfall like this was made 12% heavier and twice as likely to happen. That's according to analysis by scientists at the World Weather Attribution Network. But beyond that, did political failings compound the region's vulnerability and increase its death toll? What lessons can and must be learnt from the tragedy if we are to adapt and survive on our fast warming planet? Those were questions which I was keen to put to politicos Aitor Hernandez Morales, whose reporting I've been following closely as the story develops.
What we know is that as early as October 25th, there were clear warnings from the National Meteorological Agency, the AMET, saying that torrential rains were coming and that there could be a really catastrophic scenario unfolding on the Spanish coastline, on Spain's Mediterranean coastline. And yet on October 29th, when those rains arrive, what we see is a regional government that always seems to be about 6 to 10 hours behind the needed response time. So from the very first hour of that morning, the National Meteorological Agency declares the entire region to be in extreme danger. And yet the regional president went along his day as if it were business as usual. He attended his normal meetings. He then went on to meet with civil society members to accept an award for sustainable tourism. And this was happening at the same moment that the rivers were already beginning to overflow, and at a time where it seems that there were already victims of this natural disaster. Unfortunately, the warning that went out to the region's inhabitants, which was sent out by the regional government, only went out at 8:12 p.m. So this was at a moment when many people were already in flooded homes, and certainly where at a moment when many people were stranded in their cars. Ultimately, what we know now is that there are at least 212 confirmed dead. There are still over 80 people missing. And we're looking at catastrophic losses in terms of material losses, so buildings and infrastructure across the region. So that would be the main failure. And then what we could arguably have is also a failure of Spain's semi-federal system, in the sense that the national government has not been able to really act in this respect because the regional government has exclusive competence over emergency management. There is a reason to this system, which is basically that experts have said that when it comes to civil protection, when it comes to emergency response, the government figures closest to the ground, so regional and local figures, are the ones who are in the best position to administer that help because they know the terrain, they know the people, they know where they need to send things. So the technical system is correct, but unfortunately, when the partners at the regional and local level are not responding or don't really know how to handle the crisis, that's where this entire system seems to fall apart.
So a failure of political infrastructure, perhaps a failure of civil infrastructure too. I know that you have a civil engineering background, so I wanted to ask you this question. There is extraordinary footage of a Roman-era dam holding out against apocalyptic levels of floodwater, whilst more modern structures gave way.
Yeah, it really is a remarkable situation where indeed we saw this Roman era dam in the Aragon region, so slightly north of where the worst of the rains fell. It held up very well, and that is certainly a testament to Roman concrete and the construction tactics of the Roman Empire. But more broadly, what this disaster really does remind Spaniards and certainly all Europeans is that we absolutely need to rethink the way that we're building our cities. And with that, I mean that Valencia is a region that's grown dramatically over the past couple of decades. It gained over 1 million new inhabitants just since the beginning of this millennium. And what that led to was very quick and arguably haphazard construction tactics, where a lot of homes were built in areas that were at risk of floods. Now, admittedly, when these homes were built, people thought that they would be at risk for floods that might come every 50, 100, 200 years. But the problem is that with climate change, that entire timing scenario has been completely changed. And now the once-in-a-century floods are happening every decade, sometimes even faster. So I think that there's really going to be a reckoning in Valencia, and there will definitely be a conversation about whether many of the destroyed or affected homes should be rebuilt. And I think more broadly, this is a lesson for all of Europe. Certainly any cities built near the coastline and near riverbeds need to take note of what's happened here and understand that this is a very real threat to their own populations.
So a reckoning in Valencia, perhaps a reckoning in Azerbaijan too, with COP29 about to be held in Baku. What are the lessons that the Spanish delegation will be bringing with them?
So Pedro Sánchez's government, the center-left government that has been governing Spain since 2018, is certainly a coalition government that's very focused on climate adaptation, climate mitigation, and green energy sources. The outgoing deputy prime minister, who's about to become the competition commissioner for the EU, Teresa Rivera, has been one of the leading voices pushing to increase investments in green energy in Spain and to really focus on climate resilience in cities. And I expect the Spanish delegation will be all the more forceful in Baku, really insisting that we need to move away from fossil fuels, we need to move away from gas-guzzling automobiles, and really put the emphasis on decarbonization simply because it's something that can't be ignored. This is a threat that really is directly affecting us at home. And these disasters are part of a new reality, but they could be so much worse if climate change continues.
My thanks to Aitor Hernandez-Morales of Politico for that interview. And we will be linking to Aitor's reporting in our show notes. As we mentioned there, the COP29 climate summit is now just days away from opening in Baku, Azerbaijan. We will, of course, be featuring voices from the summit in our upcoming programmes, as well as taking a closer look at Azerbaijan's human rights record and the problems it poses for a credible approach to climate justice. Our sister podcast, Living Planet, will, of course, also be covering COP29. You will find them in all the usual podcast places. Now, for something quite different, in a week in which people have been fond of reminding us that those who do not learn from history are doomed to repeat it, we do in fact have an actual history lesson for you. 4 months after World War II's all-important Normandy landings in the fall of 1944, Allied forces fought their way through northern Flanders, heading for the Netherlands. Their target, Walcheren Island, on the western tip of the Scheldt River on the North Sea. At the top of the Scheldt, Antwerp had been liberated a month earlier and was now a logistics hub for the Allied advance to Germany. But German troops held Walcheren and Scheldt waters were mined. On November 1st, 1944, Allied commandos crossed the western Scheldt, landing on a beach just outside the fishing village of Vlissingen. Uncle Beach, they named it. After 2 days of bloody fighting, Vlissingen was liberated. Walcheren's capital, Middelburg, fell to the Allies just 2 days later. Over 12,000 Allied forces were killed or injured in the 2 month Battle of the Scheldt, half of them Canadian. 80 years later, the people of Vlissingen and the families of veterans remember. David Kattenberg reports from Uncle Beach.
Vlissingen sits on the southern edge of Walcheren Island at the mouth of the Scheldt River in the Dutch province Zeeland. From the train station, it's a 15-minute walk to town down a broad, paved dike. To the south, huge container ships cruise up the Scheldt to Antwerp, straight ahead, an iconic Dutch site, a windmill gazing down on Uncle Beach 80 years ago, in the early hours of Friday, November 1st, 1944. It was the perfect landmark for Allied commandos crossing the Scheldt from Dutch Flanders. Bloody street battles ensued. 2 days later, Vlissingen was liberated in ruins and flooded. Allied forces had bombed Walcheren's dikes. José Lazou was just a year old at the time. Her parents' memories are now her own.
Yeah, Vlissingen was flooded with seawater. Everybody has to move in their houses. The animals have to move also in the house, yeah? Cats and dogs, because of the water was around it. So...
Hundreds crowd into Vlissingen's medieval church to commemorate Vlissingen's liberation. Then they stroll down to Uncle Beach, led by a military band. I sidle up to Dutch historian Tobias van Hent.
Most of the people talk about four famous battles: the Battle of Normandy, the Battle of Arnhem, the Battle of the Bulge, and also the move across the Rhine. But to our opinion, there should be a fifth one, and that's the Battle of the Scheldt.
12,000 Allied troops were killed and injured in the month-long Battle of the Scheldt. Half of them Canadian. The Canucks never got their due, says Van Hent.
The Canadian army was called the Cinderella Army. They were doing all the heavy fightings, but they were not invited for the celebrations.
They forgot to invite the Canadians. So this is typical Canadian.
Robert Katzberg is Dutch, not Canadian, but he's written seven books about the Battle of the Scheldt and takes Canadians on tours. Today, we visit flat polderlands on the eastern end of the Scheldt where Canadians fought and died.
It is flat as a pancake, and if you put a machine gun at the cross-section of two dikes, you can control up to 5 kilometers of country. So one corporal with two soldiers would creep along the side of a dike until being fired upon.
One of those soldiers was Bill Segrif. Segrif's great-nephew has come to see where his great-uncle perished.
My great-uncle, Private William Bill Segrif from East York, Ontario. He joined in January 5th, 1944, was assigned to the Black Watch, the Royal Highland Regiment out of Montreal, and spent 60 days fighting overseas and perished on October 13th in Woensdrecht during Black Friday.
So Rob's great-uncle would have been kind of like right
yes.
here.
Yeah, yeah, sure. And the chance is 90% that he got killed here.
Who was this young man?
Well, that's a great question, and I wish I knew him better. He obviously was brave. He recognized the value of service and what that meant to the country. For that, I'm proud.
Downstream from Woensdrecht, hundreds gather at Uncle Beach, Vlissingen.
Today we will remember the heroic commandos and soldiers that started the liberation of Walcheren 80 years ago.
One of the commandos who died liberating Vlissingen was a Scotsman named Bill Harvey. Harvey's wife was 7 months pregnant at the time. The son he never knew remembers. Can you introduce yourself?
I'm Bill Harvey, son of William Harvey. He landed here on the 1st of November, 44. They fought their way up into the town. His friend had a rifle and was going ahead, and he pulled them back. My dad was a Bren gunner, and my dad stepped out and was machine gunned. So I never knew my dad. He was killed in November 1944, and I was born January 45.
Everyone knows about the Normandy invasion. Who remembers the Battle of the Scheldt here in Vlissingen? Many do, and weep. For DW, I'm David Kattenberg at Uncle Beach, Vlissingen, in southwestern Nederland.
Lest we forget, I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. You're listening to Inside Europe.
Parting is such sweet sorrow.
Now, I promised you a wild goose chase. Our editor, Helen Sini, thinks I'm talking about a lovely audio exploration of the migratory lives of wild geese. This is a report that actually really does exist and which I promise to share with you one day very soon. What Helen doesn't know, however, is that that report has itself been something of a wild goose chase for her this week, because I had something different planned all along. Come on, Helen, you didn't think I'd let you retire that quietly, did you?
Deutsche Welle, Köln.
Hello and welcome to Inside Europe. I'm Helen Sini in Cologne. On today's program,
сегодня я последний раз обращаюсь к вам как президент.
A new millennium and a new boss in the Kremlin. Boris Yeltsin announces his resignation. Also on the program, hello and welcome to Inside Europe. I'm Helen Sini in Cologne. On today's programme, Afghan women refugees in Turkey head home to add their skills to the reconstruction effort. There are many
countries. DW Inside Europe.
Hello and welcome. I'm Helen Sini in Germany. On today's programme, are Zelensky's conditions for peace in Ukraine at odds with the realities of the war?
The DW time machine there, leaving me wondering, why on earth did they change the sound design? Whatever. The point is this. Helen Sini is something of a unique phenomenon in the world of European broadcasting. And I honestly cannot think of another broadcaster who could be retiring at the age of 63. Happy birthday, Helen. It is today, I believe. After some 40 years championing cross-border European journalism, over 30 of which were spent at the helm of one programme, Inside Europe, whether behind the mic as a presenter or, as in more recent years, behind the scenes as an editor. To the very last, and boy, Helen, you sure did pick your week to go. Helen's career has been lived in parallel with European history in the making. Here's our time machine again.
Join us now for another installment of our series, After the Revolution, the Changing Face of Eastern Europe. Like other East Bloc countries, Bulgaria threw off its communist yoke 10 years ago in a bloodless revolution. But since then, the country has failed to keep pace with the progress made elsewhere in Eastern Europe. Helen Sini has been to Bulgaria to discover just how much change there's been over the last decade.
At the office of the weekly newspaper, the Sofia Echo, editor-in-chief Georgi Apostolov is anxiously smoking a cigarette. The computers have been breaking down all morning, and the deadline for getting the page proofs to the printer was 2 hours ago. One of the staff casually asks if there have been any rumours of pay. The answer is not encouraging. Wages seem to be somewhat sporadic. But Georgi Apostolov knows that he and his staff are better off than most Bulgarians.
On European criteria, I would say that 90% of Bulgarians are...
Following the fall of the Soviet Union, Helen's interest in the newly opened up countries of Eastern Europe made her a pioneering figure, keen to search out new stories and new voices. Here's one of them. Inside Europe listeners will know him as Julian Werner.
I first met Helen on a visit to the old Deutsche Welle broadcasting house in Cologne over 3 decades ago, shortly after the then Inside Europe boss offered me the Poland freelance correspondence job. Helen had just joined the Inside Europe team, which was then much larger than now. Among the team, Helen came across as the friendliest and the most direct, with a distinct Aussie sense of humour. Her background as an Australian who spent her childhood in the UK gave her an extra perspective on European affairs. But above all, I instantly noticed her enthusiasm and great knowledge of Central and Eastern Europe, which was then going through tumultuous change. As a producer, Helen wanted Inside Europe listeners to find out what these changes meant for ordinary people. For most other international broadcasters, the collapse of the Berlin Wall was the top story, but soon afterwards, the focus shifted elsewhere, As a result, audiences were left with lots of unanswered questions as to what came after the wall's collapse. To fill that gap, wherever possible, Helen relied on local reporters who could provide a broader background. So a Pole reported from Warsaw, a Latvian covered Baltic stories, etc. Over the time, Helen has built up an impressive network of contacts in the region and developed a special personal relationship with each of us.
And it wasn't just in Eastern Europe that Helen was seeding careers either, as our Paris correspondent John Lawrenson remembers.
So, Helen, I thought long and hard about what to give you for your retirement and thought a really long answer machine message never fails to please. Helen, you and I go a long way back. You are my most long-standing colleague. I don't remember much about 1990, but I do remember standing by a lift in the Maison de la Radio, feeling very pleased with myself because I just talked on the telephone to someone called Helen Seney, Australian by the sound of it, in charge of a programme called Inside Europe at a radio station called Deutsche Welle. And she is willing to pay me good, wholesome Deutschmarks for my first ever radio reportage about people in Alsace welcoming Croatian refugees.
John Lawrenson there, just one of the many correspondents and collaborators who have been sending in audio tributes for Helen this week. We don't have time to play them all, unfortunately, but here's a quick sample.
Hi, Helen, it's Rob in Prague. I feel a bit betrayed, to be honest. I thought we had a deal that we'd never stop working. In fact, last night I was looking through my computer and I keep records of every single script I've ever written. Ridiculous, I know. And there is a folder called Inside Europe.
Hi, Helen. This is Lisa in Paris. It's always been a real pleasure working with you. You've been so enthusiastic.
Hi, Helen. This time I'm not speaking to you from the Hauptstadt studio, but a bit further away. I'm in Colombia, in South America, on holiday.
Hey, Helen, Ben here. I'm really grateful to have had the opportunity to work with you and learn from you over the past 4 years. And I would like to thank you.
Hi, Helen, this is Angelo from Rome. I was very surprised to hear that you're leaving. And to be honest, I'm a bit sad as well about that.
Helen, hello, it's Joe Impey here. I can't believe you're actually leaving.
Helen Seney, presenter, producer extraordinaire. When I look through my old email exchanges with you, there are literally hundreds, and rereading them makes me chuckle. Helen, you've always trusted me to tell a story in my own way.
Dear Helen, Rob here. It has been an absolute pleasure. What a time we had working together on Inside Europe. A real highlight of my time at DW. You've shaped so many shows and careers over your time at DW.
Thank you also to all the many listeners who wrote in via the InsideEurope@dw.com address to wish Helen all the best and share your memories of listening to her over the years and, in a couple of cases, even of working with her. I promise that I will make sure that she gets every single one of your messages. For myself, what can I say except that it has been an honour and a privilege? Helen, your knowledge and experience are as deep and as warm as your chuckle, and I shall miss you deeply. Now, over to Stefan Boss in Budapest.
Helen, I am sure I'm singing on behalf of many people when I'm just wondering, all of me, why don't you take all of me, my baby? Can't you see? I can't live without you. Take my arms. I want to lose them. Oh, take my lips. I'll never use them. Your goodbyes left me with eyes that cry.
This programme was produced by Helen Seney with help from me, Kate Laycock, and sound engineers Timon Heidorn and Michael Springer. Inside Europe comes to you from DW in Bonn, Germany. We'll be right back.